Lecture 5, Performance and Discharge.
Greetings. Today we're going to talk about performance and discharge. And that sounds a little questionable, I know, but we're talking about contracts here. Don't worry. The performance and discharge basically deals with the situation of when you have a contract. Heretofore, we've just been talking about how you get into a contract or how you avoid getting into a contract. Now, let's suppose you have one. You've got a contract. What do you do? Well, it would be nice and logical to assume the first thing you do is perform the contract. So the way out of a contract, the way to extinguish your liabilities in a contract and, you know, get the right to be paid, is by performing your part of the contract. So performance is the first issue. You're going to perform the contract. Now, how do you go about doing that? Now, that seems pretty logical, too. You do what it says you're supposed to do. So perfect performance is the logical way to get out of the contract. Perfect performance. Do exactly what you're supposed to do. And once you engage in your perfect performance, and once you complete it, you've done everything you can be expected to do, and you've got a right to be paid. So that's good. And if all contracts work this way, life would be much easier, but they don't. Why? Because performance, like everything else in life, is seldom perfect. If you contract for something, it's just not going to be perfect. Now, it depends, of course, on the type of contract. Some, you know, contracts for the sale of retail goods are pretty close to perfect, at least as perfect as promised, but most contracts aren't. If you ever bought a house, you know, I don't know if you ever built a house, but building a house is a classic example here. You build a house, what do? You go to an architect, get them to draw up all these detailed specifications. You also have detailed specifications for, you know, what you want your cabinets to look like, what you want your hardware to be. So you've got all that. Then the builder comes in and builds it. And maybe a great builder, maybe it did a great job, but is it perfect? Is it ever going to be perfect? No. There's going to be something wrong with that house. It may be something big, such as they installed the bathrooms upside down, you know, on the ceiling. Makes them very difficult to use. Okay. Or it may be something very small. It may be that you have silver knobs instead of brass ones on your kitchen cabinets. So you've now got this house that's not perfect, and you're building a house, you really want it to be perfect, and it's not perfect, and so you say, I don't want it, I'm not moving in. Well, can you reject that contract for the failure of perfect performance? Well, probably not. If there is what's called substantial performance, you cannot get out of the contract. So in the examples I talked about here, the wrong type of metal on the kitchen cabinets would not give you grounds to get out of that contract. You'd be stuck with it. You'd have to replace them or something. On the other hand, upside down bathrooms probably would. And the key question here is, have we had substantial performance? Has the contractor substantially performed, done the job close to right, or has there been a material breach? This is the converse. You have substantial performance where they've done the job essentially right, or a material breach of contract where they've made some mistake in the contract that is so substantial that it's considered material and may authorize you to get out of the contract. Well, how do you decide when performance is substantial? When someone's performance is substantial enough, you've got to go along and got to pay. Well, there are several factors we look at. Well, mainly two factors you look at. One is percentage completion. Percentage completion. You look into what percent is done. Well, you can't always, I don't suppose, assign a percentage to these things. But in our house example, I think you would say that having kitchen cabinet knobs that were the wrong type, probably 99.9% done. Everything was put in right. They got one little small product wrong. So percentage completion, you know, that's about 99%. As for the bathrooms upside down, I don't know what percent you would assign that. That would be a lesser percentage, obviously. It still might be a big percent, but that doesn't necessarily make it substantial performance. So if you can assign a percentage completion, there you have part of your decision on whether performance is substantial. If performance is 90% or 95%, that's substantial performance. You're going to have to pay. Well, do you have to pay the total amount in that case? Do you have to pay exact contract price? No, not necessarily, and probably not. If the lack of completion costs you some money to correct it, then you can deduct that from the contract price. But you're still stuck with the contract. You just may be expected to pay a little bit less. What if your builder had put no knobs on the kitchen cabinets so you could not even get into them? Would that be substantial? You have kitchen cabinets, I can't get into them. What good are they? That's still substantial performance because you can hire someone to pay the builder or hire somebody else to come out there and put the little knobs on for a pretty small amount. And what you would do is you would have to pay the full price, you know, that you'd agreed to pay for the house minus whatever cost you had in correcting those small little knobs. Now, the trickier question is, once they've put in the knobs in silver and you want them in brass, can you deduct the cost of replacing them? If it's a small little cost, perhaps, very possibly, yes. Sometimes, though, it may be considered too inefficient to do that. We'll talk about some examples of that, too. So this is, this is the first criterion for deciding whether performance is substantial. And the contract has been fundamentally fulfilled, percentage completion. Number two is degree of benefit. The degree of benefit from the contract after the performance has been not quite completed, not quite done right. So you might think percentage completion correlates pretty closely with degree of benefit. If you have 99% completion, you have 99% degree of benefit. But no, if you think about it, you'll find some times where that's not the case. I think the bathroom case is one where you could say percentage completion is over 90%. Every other room in the house was done right, perhaps. But your degree of benefit from the house with unusable bathrooms has declined considerably. House without bathrooms isn't of very much use. Let's take another example, and simpler perhaps example, is suppose you have a big piece of land and you're going to put onto that land some prize horses. You've got some very expensive horses, and so you contract with someone to build a fence around your land to keep those horses in. You don't want to lose them. They're very valuable. Don't want them running out on the road, running into cars and things. So they go in and they build that fence, and they get that fence, say, 95% done. Well, but 95% done leaves a pretty big hole in the fence. So you put the horses in there. The horses are smart enough to find a hole in a fence usually. They all get away. Well, that's a case where the percentage completion was great, but the degree of benefit was minimal. So that's not substantial performance. That, of course, would be a material breach. There are a lot of painting examples here. Suppose you hire someone to paint your house, and he gets it 95% done. It's 95% painted. Then he runs out of paint, takes off for the day, and quits. So you have a house that's 95% this lovely pink color you want, and the other 5% is the underlying green or something. And, that doesn't look very good at all. So do you think that would be substantial performance? That's a pretty good case that it would, yes, be substantial performance. You could say, well, hey, I didn't get much benefit. My house looks worse now, 95% pink and 5% green, than it did, you know, when it was 100% green. The reason why that might well be considered substantial performance is you could get somebody else to finish it up cheaply, and you could just deduct that from the contract price. Assuming you can, perhaps this color of pink is irreproducible, and you can't ever get the final 5% done right. Then maybe it's not substantial performance, then maybe you don't owe, but that's probably not very likely. So, degree of benefit. And then I should throw in a third factor that courts sometimes look to on substantial versus insubstantial performance, and that is the good faith of the party that was doing the performing. If somebody does 90% of the job because they did their best, and they couldn't do 100% because perhaps materials were unavailable, then we're more likely to call that substantial performance. If somebody does 90% of the job and then takes off because they got a better offer, that's not such good faith, and we are more likely to find that to be a material breach where you are not obliged to accept the contract and you're not obliged to take the house or take the whatever. So the key to completing your obligations in a contract is performance. You want perfect performance. Substantial performance is the best we understand we can hope for in many circumstances. But it's got to be substantial. It's got to get most of the way there, or that the other party doesn't need to pay you. If you have made a material breach, the other party doesn't need to pay you, and you have lost all of your expenses in doing this 90% of the job, potentially. Of course, if it was a house and you were the builder and they didn't accept it, you could try to resell it or something. You're not necessarily out of pocket, but sometimes you are. If you know you've painted 90% of a house and you take off and it's a material breach, you've lost that. That's worthless. Okay, now, there's another type of contract where performance is a little trickier. And these are personal satisfaction contracts. Personal satisfaction contracts. Sometimes someone will make a contract with you where they must perform something to your personal satisfaction. Well, obviously that's a little bit trickier. What if you're not satisfied? Do you have to pay? No, you don't, as a general rule. Now, we break down these personal satisfaction contracts into two types, sometimes called aesthetic and mechanical. Aesthetic and mechanical. Now, most personal satisfaction contracts are aesthetic. This would be you want someone to paint your portrait to hang over your fireplace. Well, that's very nice. So you hire this great artist. You write for them a personal satisfaction contract. I will pay you such and such amount of money when you paint a portrait of me that meets my personal satisfaction. Well, artists are terribly frustrated by these because what they'll do is they'll paint a portrait of you that looks exactly like you, the spitting image. But do you want to see that? No, that doesn't meet with your personal satisfaction. God, that looks terrible. That doesn't look like me. I don't look that bad, right? And so, what about that? What if the artist makes it look perfectly like you and you don't like it? Who wins that? You win. The artist loses. If the artist enters into a personal satisfaction contract, the artist has got to paint you to look like your personal satisfaction contract. And if people then come over and say, my God, why is Mel Gibson hanging over your fireplace? You have to explain, well, actually, that's how I looked when I was younger, you know. They've got to do it. Now, there is one condition on you in your personal satisfaction contract. That is, you've got to use good faith. That is, if it sincerely is not of your satisfaction, that's okay. You can say, no, it doesn't meet my satisfaction. But if you're just trying to weasel out of the contract, leaving this artist with this portrait of you, which I don't know why anyone else would want, you can't do it. You have to, you know, make a good faith effort to be satisfied. But if you try, and after you've made that good faith effort to be satisfied, you're not, you say, I just don't like it. You can tell them, no, change it, redo it. That's okay. Now, there's a somewhat different rule for what are called mechanical or objective personal satisfaction contracts. I mean, you might hire a car mechanic to fix your radiator to your personal satisfaction. Well, that would be a little strange, I think, but you could write such a contract. And then, you know, the car mechanic takes it to you, presents it to you, you look at it and say, no, that doesn't meet my satisfaction. It's I don't like the color. Well, they don't let you get away with the same sort of whim of satisfaction on these objective or mechanical contracts. On something like that, if it is reasonable by an objective standard, if an ordinary person would find it to be reasonable, that's good enough. You know, if it's considered to be a mechanical sort of thing. A computer, now doing a computer program, I don't know how you'd resolve that. I think that's got some elements of both. I mean, if the computer program is supposed to do something mechanical, then you could say it's mechanical and just has to be objectively good enough. But computer, you know, visuals today are so important and graphics are so good. On the other hand, there's a little aesthetic component there to, you know, designing software. That one, as far as I know, is up in the air. All right, let's turn to another performance issue, and that is delay in performance. A delay in performance. Typically, contracts specify that performance must be by such and such a time. What if they're a day late? Can you reject them? Can you say, you're a day late and a dollar short, and I don't want it, the contract's off, you have breached the contract by showing up a day late? Is that a circumstance where you can get out of a contract where they show up a day late? The answer generally is no. Generally, the answer is no. Being late for a contract is not a material breach, could be substantial performance. Well, it depends on, of course, how late. If it's several years late, well, that'll be a material breach. But a little bit late is good enough. You have to let them go ahead, do the contract. You have to pay them. You can deduct any damages you suffered from them being a day or two late. I don't know what those would be. If you want to be absolutely certain that performance is by a given time, you have to make it clear that time is of the essence. You have to make it clear that time is of the essence. When is time of the essence? Well, time is of the essence when the other party either knows or should know that time is of the essence. You're hiring somebody to do yard work. Well, ordinarily, doing yard work is not a case where time is of the essence. If they're 2 days late in mowing your yard, you know, it's going to look a little bit raggedy for a couple of days, but it's not a big deal. It's still substantial performance. Unless, of course, Architectural Digest or someone is coming out to photograph your house, or it's being photographed for that magazine they sent, Luxury Homes and Estates, you know, where you're going to sell it. You're trying to sell it to this magazine they sell all over the country. In that case, time may be of the essence. You know, they take a picture of your house on a given day and you've got a ratty-looking front yard because the guy didn't come and do it. Well, in that circumstance, I think you might be able to say that was a material breach. You didn't get it done on time. But you can only say that if you let the yard guy know that it has to be on this day because, you know, someone's coming to take photographs on the next day. That's the case where time is of the essence and delay in performance may be a material breach. If it's known to the other party that time is indeed of the essence and that you have to be there on time, or it's just not of nearly the same benefit to you. Okay? That's delay in performance as substantial performance. Next, we could say a little bit about sales contracts. There are a lot of business goes through sales contracts, and these are governed by, as you know, the UCC, the Uniform Commercial Code. And the Uniform Commercial Code has some of its own rules for performance and discharge of contracts. And according to the UCC, there is a perfect tender rule. Tender here doesn't mean kind or thoughtful. It means delivery of the goods. And the perfect tender rule means that you have to deliver the goods perfectly in order to be paid. In theory, under the UCC, if the goods are imperfect, thus the buyer can back out. In reality, it really doesn't work that way. In reality, the buyer has a little less flexibility than that, cannot reject goods at a whim for there being some slight imperfection. And later on, I'm going to talk about the seller's obligations and the buyer's obligations in a sales contract. At this point, just know that the UCC specifies that performance is supposed to be perfect. We'll see how they've gotten around that to some degree in the application of the law. So, now obviously this is the main central way to escape the terms of a contract. That is through performance of the contract. Is there any other way that a contract is discharged? Is there any other way that a contract dies? Can you get out of a contract by anything other than doing performance? Maybe you don't want to do performance. And yes, many contracts are discharged for reasons other than performance, substantial, perfect, or otherwise. One way that contracts are discharged is by failure of a condition. Contracts may have a condition on them. Many of these conditions are express conditions. That is, they are stated in the contract. There's an express condition in the contract, and if the contract fails, if it's a condition precedent, and the condition doesn't happen, the contract goes away. Contract goes poof. I mean, that's sad to think of the butterfly going poof, but it does. If the condition doesn't happen. Now, condition subsequent is roughly the same thing, but condition precedent has to happen before there is a contract. Condition subsequent, I guess, is where the butterfly goes poof. Condition subsequent discharges a contract that already exists. The condition must happen or you have no contract in either case. Let me take an example. Let's say you are interested in purchasing a racehorse. You want to put the racehorse out to stud and make lots of money, you know, from making little baby racehorses. But you realize that, and you negotiate a certain price, you realize the value of this racehorse depends on how good a racehorse it is. People will, you know, want to give you their mares the better your horse is. So, you may write in a condition on the contract that you will buy this horse for $100,000 if it finishes in the money at the Belmont Stakes, say. So there's a condition. And if the horse finishes in the money at the Belmont Stakes, then the condition precedent has been met, and you have to pay the $100,000 for the racehorse. But what if the horse finishes out of the money for some reason? What if it comes in fifth? The condition fails. The contract is off. That contract is discharged, and you no longer have to pay the money for that racehorse because the condition fails. And many contracts have some sort of condition like this. Now, it's important, at this stage, it's important to distinguish a condition from a promise. To distinguish a condition from a promise. Let's go back to our home building. When you built that home, you specified brass cabinet hardware, correct? When you go in there and you see the silver, you shriek. And you say, this won't do, this won't do, I won't buy this house. And the builder smugly says, well, you know, I have substantial performance, you have to pay this house, you know, this little error doesn't mean very much. And you say, heck no. Brass hardware was a condition on the contract. Because it's not brass hardware, that condition was not met and the contract is off. Who's right? Well, in the ordinary run of events, in an ordinary building contract, the builder would be right. That brass hardware, that wasn't a condition on the contract, that was a promise of the contract. And a promise can be fulfilled by substantial performance. But a condition cannot. A condition cannot be fulfilled by substantial performance. So if you were obsessive about brass or silver or something, you could, in theory, make that a condition of the contract. How would you make it a condition of the contract? You'd say it was a condition of the contract. A condition of this contract is that the silver, the hardware, be brass. You put it in, you write it in as a condition. It is a condition, and unless it's right, you can get out of the contract. So, the presumption is the terms of a contract are promises, not conditions. But if something's terribly important to you, more important to you than it would be to the average person, write it in as a condition. Make sure they've got it exactly right. Because a condition has to be met exactly or the contract's off, unlike performance of a promise. Those are express conditions in contract. Now, some contracts also have what are called constructive conditions. These are not written in the contract. These are essentially applied by law. One main constructive condition is the order of performance. Suppose I'm sending you some goods and you're going to pay me for them. And that's all we say in the contract. And you say, where are the goods? And I say, where's the money? You say, I want my goods first. And I say, I want my money first. Alphonse and Gaston. Who has breached the contract? Which of us has breached the contract? Who can sue? The answer is nobody's probably breached the contract yet. Neither one of us can sue. The way that the constructive conditions work is that my obligation, that his obligation to pay for the goods doesn't arise until I tender, provide him the goods. My obligation to tender the goods may not arise until he tenders, offers to give me payment. So you could have a standoff. No one would be in breach of contract in that case. However, that's where it's a sale of goods. That's the general order of performance for that. But you have a different rule if one person's performance takes time. Suppose I retain you to paint my house. Well, what is the performance there? My performance to you is giving you a check if you take them, or cash if you don't. Your performance to me is coming out and painting the house. And the rule is that if one side's performance takes a period of time, takes a long time, that person has to go first. So the rule is that in the case of the house painting, the painter has to go first and complete it before I have any obligation under the contract. Another constructive condition in most contracts, if not all, is what's called a covenant of good faith. That is, you will use your good faith in fulfilling the contract. You won't try to weasel out of it by some little thing or another. Okay, so these are conditions. And if these conditions fail, you can get out of the contract, except there may be an excuse of conditions. Conditions may be excused sometimes, and the contract can come back into force. Let's go back to our racehorse. I want to buy your horse, $100,000. Condition says it finishes in the top three at Belmont. Horse comes in fourth. Now, we'd say that contract is off, correct? But I like the way the horse was closing at the end, so I say, what the heck, I'll waive the condition. I'll give up my right to get out of the contract under the condition. I'll go ahead and buy that horse. Then we have a contract again on those same old terms that we negotiated. So conditions may be waived by the beneficiary, or if it's not clear who the beneficiary is, it might have to be waived by both parties. These conditions can be waived, and you can bring the contract back if you decide you don't want to hold the other party to them quite so strictly. Another way to excuse conditions is hindrance of the condition. Now let's go back to the Belmont Stakes. Now I have agreed to buy your horse for $100,000 if your horse finishes in the top three, right? But I decide, oh, this was a terrible mistake. I don't have the money. I don't want to get into this business. I can't afford it. Please, please, please don't finish in the top three. Right? I'm praying that this horse doesn't finish in the top three so I can get out of the contract on the failure of the condition. And I get a nice seat at the rail just so I can watch this happen. Well, lo and behold, we're coming along. We're on the backstretch. Your horse is way out front. You've got four lengths on everybody else. It's clear he's going to finish in the top three, and the condition's going to go forward. So I take out a tranquilizer gun right there and go, shoot the horse. Fault goes down 10 feet before the finish line, finishes last. I'm out of the contract. Good deal, eh? No, of course that doesn't work. I hindered the condition. Because I hindered the condition, I cannot then rely on this condition to get out of the contract. One common example of a condition that creates problems is satisfactory financing. If instead of buying a racehorse, I was going to buy a big company, I would probably make an offer to buy this company, and that offer would be contingent upon or conditioned upon my ability to obtain satisfactory financing, a loan or some other equity finance to buy the company. So this is a sort of tricky condition. If I don't get financing, the condition fails, the contract is off, I don't have to buy the company. Now I have to use good faith to try and get that financing. I cannot hinder that financing by saying to the bank, well, yes, I need a loan for $5 million to buy this company, and you probably should know that I've decided to become an embezzler and steal it and move to Argentina. And then the bank doesn't make me the loan, and I turn to you and say, oh, I'm sorry, no satisfactory financing. Yeah, you can't do that. You've got to use your good faith effort to get satisfactory financing once you agree to a contract that has this as a condition. And likewise, the person selling the company has to use good faith in deciding what sort of financing is satisfactory or sufficient or however the wording of the contract might be. Okay, that's how you get out of a contract on conditions. There's a third way that contracts are ended or die, and that is under impossibility. Sometimes performance of a contract becomes impossible. Now you might say, well, that's the tough luck of the guy who's supposed to perform it. And it may be in some cases if you've allocated the risk of impossibility, but as a general rule, the presence of impossibility discharges the contract, ends the contract. Now impossibility is judged here by an objective standard. Could it possibly be done? And one way that this impossibility arises is the destruction of the subject matter, particularly the destruction of a unique subject matter. Let's think of a couple of examples. Suppose that I am supposed to build a building for you, and I'm 80% of the way through, and the building burns down. Is that contract discharged for impossibility? Can I say, well, I tried, I have to get out of the contract, it was impossible, the building burned down? No, probably not. That would not be discharged for impossibility, because it is not impossible for me to provide that building, I just have to start over, right? So I can't get out of that contract building you a building just because the building burned down. But what if I am supposed to put bathrooms into the third and fourth floors of this building, and then the building burns down and is not rebuilt? Well, that's pretty obviously discharged for impossibility. I don't have an obligation to put bathrooms in the third and fourth floor of a building that does not even exist. So that one would be discharged for impossibility. So if the destruction of the subject matter is something unique that can't be replaced, then it's impossible. But if it can be replaced, then it's not impossible. You have to replace it. Another way that contracts may be discharged for impossibility is the failure of an essential third person. The failure of an essential third person. Suppose I am a middleman, middle person, and I am supposed to be providing you with goods from Company X. I'm just, you know, taking care of all the middle arrangements. And then Company X goes away or stops producing these goods. You still want your goods from, your contract's with me. You still want your goods from me, right? I say, I'm sorry, Company X went out of business. You say, that doesn't help, doesn't matter to me. I expect you to provide those goods. Am I bound? Do I have to pay damages? No, because I'm discharged for impossibility because it was due to the failure of a third person. There's nothing I can do about it. There's no way I can get around it. So that contract is gone and discharged for impossibility in that case. Akin to impossibility is a doctrine called impracticability. Impracticability. This is where circumstances make it extremely uneconomic to complete the contract. It would just be terribly economically inefficient to complete the contract. Now, this only works where the economic change is extreme and was not foreseeable. In one famous old case, a person had agreed to harvest all of the timber on someone's mountainside and was going to get, I guess, a percentage of the sales cost of the timber for doing it. And this was a big mountain covered with timber, and so there was lots of money to be had and made here. Then there was a forest fire. All of the timber burned except for a handful of trees on some rocky crag sticking off the mountain. Now the owner of the mountain says, well, hey, I've got a contract here. I might as well get some money out of those few trees on that rocky crag. The person who is to do the harvesting of the timber says, whoa, wait, this is a big change. I was going to be able to harvest this whole mountainside of trees at a reasonable price. But if I have to haul out all this enormous equipment, somehow get them up to that rocky crag, cut down a few trees, get a little bit of lumber, I'm going to have enormous costs. I'm not going to make any money off my percentage of the lumber. So there, the court held that contract was in fact discharged for economic impracticability. There was such a marked change in the economics of the contract that it was no longer practicable to expect the timber harvester to go ahead and do that. So they were out of the contract. Contract was called off. Now, another example of discharge of a contract is called frustration of purpose. Frustration of purpose. This is sort of like impossibility and impracticability. This is where, because of some outside event, the whole point of the contract, the purpose of the contract, is nullified and is no point to the contract anymore. The classic case here is an old British case called Krell v. Henry. The British coronation would proceed down certain streets when they were crowning a new king or queen. And the people who had apartments overlooking these streets had a pretty good deal. They would rent their apartments out for 1 or 2 days to, you know, people who loved the royals and wanted to watch the coronation for whatever reason. So this is what happened. A fellow rented his apartment out at a pretty steep price for a couple of days so one of the royal lovers could watch the coronation pass by on the street below him. Then what happened? The to-be king got sick and the coronation was postponed. Now the person who rented the apartment is now paying for 2 days of this, or a day or two of this apartment, an extremely high price without a point. He says, well, I want out of this contract. I don't want this contract. The guy who rented the apartment said, well, you rented for these 2 days, this price, we got a deal, you're stuck with it. The court said, no, you're not stuck with it, because the purpose of the contract was frustrated. You knew his purpose was to watch the coronation. You knew he couldn't watch the coronation. Frustration of purpose means he's not stuck with the contract. In deciding on whether frustration of purpose excuses you from a contract, because you have a lot of frustration out there in contracts, you look at the amount of the frustration, whether how much benefit is left. You look at the foreseeability of the frustration. How likely was it that the coronation was going to be postponed? And you look to see if there's any allocation of risk in the contract. The contract, if these people had been, you know, thinking about this, would have said something like, the risk of no coronation is allocated to the renter. You know, if there's no coronation, you're still stuck with the contract. Or something the guy doing the renting could have done that would have been smart would be to put his own condition in the contract, to say this contract is conditioned on the coronation taking place on this street at this time. But even though he didn't, he got out of the contract for frustration of purpose. A modern day example might be, suppose you enrolled in a health club, or to take an actual case, suppose you went to Arthur Murray for dance lessons. You signed up for a lot of dance lessons at Arthur Murray, thousands of dollars of dance lessons at Arthur Murray. And then, sadly, you are struck by a car and are paralyzed or confined to a wheelchair or something like that. And you have these thousands of dollars of dance lessons which are of no benefit to you under the circumstances. I mean, a health club, I guess there might still be some benefit, but the dance lessons, probably not. So under those circumstances, you want out of the contract. Well, this happened once, and Arthur Murray's contracts had a very clear statement. No refunds. Contract binding. You know, no way out. This contract, you're signing up with it, you're stuck with it. And they tried to stand on that. They tried to say, well, I'm terribly sorry about your accident, but you signed this contract, and you're stuck with it. The court said, no. The fellow gets out of the contract because his purpose was totally frustrated in the dance lessons. He could not even take the dance lessons given his now state of health. Consequently, there was frustration of purpose. The contract is off. Arthur Murray loses. Okay, now talk a little bit about the sales context, which I touched on earlier. What are the obligations of the seller and the buyer in a sales contract? Here's the way the UCC lays it out. The seller, under the UCC, the obligation first is that the seller should tender delivery of conforming goods, being those that meet what's specified in the contract, at a reasonable time, according to the contract, at a reasonable place, according to the contract. So under the UCC, the seller is supposed to go forth and tender delivery of these goods. Then, suppose the buyer doesn't like them somehow. They're not quite right. The buyer may be able to reject those goods. Now, the buyer has to use good faith here. The buyer may be able to reject those goods and say, these are not what I ordered, this is not what I want. But the buyer has to give the seller an opportunity to cure, to fix the defect after they were rejected. Well, how much time does the seller have? Well, if the seller delivered in advance of the time specified in the contract, the seller's obviously got up to the time in the contract. What if the seller didn't? What if she waited to the last minute? Does she have any time left to cure? The UCC says probably yes. You would get a little bit of extra time to cure the defect if you reasonably thought they were not defective. If, you know, you're buying a lot of potatoes from me, and you get these potatoes, and you say, well, they're not quite good enough, not quite the way I wanted them. I wanted my potatoes to be bigger. Well, then, you know, the seller's got a chance to come and supply, you know, new potatoes. On the other hand, if the seller delivers potatoes that are all rotten on the last day, they may not get a chance to cure in that circumstance. Okay, what about if you're the buyer? Well, I've already talked pretty much about your rules. If you're the buyer, you can you take the goods. You have an opportunity to examine them or inspect them to make sure they're conforming. They meet the sort of standards that you were thinking about. Then once you've done that, you have to either accept them or reject them. Once you've done that, you accept them, and then you have to pay for them if you accept them, although you can't accept them with a flaw. In other words, you get your goods, they're not perfect, they're a little bit flawed, but you say, I'll accept them and I'll just deduct from the contract price the loss of value to me as a consequence of this flaw in the goods. But if you reject them, if you say they're not good enough, you generally have to allow a reasonable amount of time for the seller to cure in a timely fashion. Okay, let's have a few review cases, see if you figure out how these should be decided. There was a sale of a pharmacy in a shopping mall. There was an operating pharmacy in a shopping mall. It was sold to another pharmacy buyer, and the sale was conditioned on renewal of a satisfactory lease for that property. In other words, the buyer doesn't want this pharmacy if it can't get a satisfactory lease for this particular space in the shopping mall. I mean, that's where it's been successful. That's what they want. Okay. Now, the selling pharmacy had sold only dry products, or whatever you call them, drugs and health care products, things like that. The purchaser wanted to sell some groceries, I suppose, you know, potato chips and candy bars, at least things like that. Well, it turns out that another renter at the shopping center had an exclusive right to sell groceries in the shopping center. So the purchaser, if he assumed any lease he could assume, could not sell groceries. So, the purchaser wants to refuse the lease. The purchaser wants out of the lease. Does the purchaser have to go through with this contract to buy that pharmacy? The answer is no. The purchaser does not, because there was a condition of a satisfactory lease. Satisfactory to the purchaser was the right to sell groceries. Because he could not get a lease with the right to sell groceries, he could not get a satisfactory lease. Therefore, the condition failed, and he gets out of the contract. Okay, let's take a housing case, since we talked about some housing cases earlier. The purchasers of a house are having a house built. The builder, for whatever reason, fails to finish the kitchen cabinets. There are no kitchen cabinets. Fails to put in gutters. Fails to put in a sidewalk, as specified in the contract. Fails to put in an entrance seat, which they wanted and had designed on their plans. And fails to put in closet clothes poles, you know, the things you put your hangers on. Well, that wasn't, doesn't seem too big, but they threw that in as another one that was failed. And another thing was there was a wall that was 1 foot misplaced. There's a wall that's 1 foot over too far. The purchaser comes in, looks at this shabby house without kitchen cabinets, says, I'm not paying a dime. The builder, I really don't know why he didn't bother to finish it, but he sues for his money. Did he make substantial performance? Should he be paid his money? Court says yes. Yes, it's not, this is clearly a flawed house. You can't hang up your clothes. But most of these things can be pretty easily and cheaply fixed. If you look at the percentage completion, when you're talking about all the things that go into a house, the percentage completion here is pretty high. If you look to degree of benefit, the degree of benefit is also pretty high when you consider that, you know, putting in a clothes pole is a pretty easy remedy. So it was substantial performance, and the builder will get paid. But how much? How much should the builder get paid? Well, obviously you can deduct for the cost of some things, such as buying closet clothes poles and putting them in, putting in the gutters, putting in the sidewalk, putting in the kitchen cabinets. Okay, you can deduct whatever cost you had for that. What about the wall that's 1 foot off? Can you bring somebody in to move the wall a foot over and deduct that cost? Well, probably not. Probably not. The court would say that, you know, if the wall being 1 foot over reduces the value of your house somehow, well, then you can deduct that value. But you probably can't go in and have somebody move the wall. That would be too much expense for no real purpose. The only exception would be is if there was some terribly important reason why the wall being 1 foot off made a big difference, such as it was an already narrow hallway that was only, 2.5 feet wide, and because it's 1 foot off, it's only 1.5 foot wide, and people can't get through it, well, then maybe you can move it. But as a general rule, no. Okay, suppose you are a member of the Crane family, and you insist that this contract use Crane brand plumbing. You want your own brand of plumbing and pipes and all that in the contract. Well, the builder says, that's not no big deal. I'm going to use Kohler. I can get a better deal. So the builder puts in Kohler. You go, it's important to you. You go down and inspect these pipes, and you discover that they're Kohler and not Crane like you wanted, and you say, I don't want this house. I can't bear living in a house. It doesn't have my family's plumbing fixtures. Can you get out of that contract? Well, ordinarily, no. I mean, that's substantial performance. I mean, the Kohler stuff is good quality stuff. It's not like it's going to fail. That's substantial performance. But if it were truly so very important to you for emotional or psychological reasons, whatever, you could specify Crane brand plumbing as a condition. If you put that in as a condition and they don't do it, you can get out of the contract and you can escape the whole house contract if it's a condition and not a promise. So if there's something that's terribly important to you but might not seem terribly important to the average person, you want to be sure it's done, you better put it in as a condition, not just as a promise. Because if it's a promise, substantial performance will suffice. Okay, that's it for performance and discharge. Thanks.